I make stuff up for a living.
That's a good way to say what we do. I hope I caught that. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Jersey.
Of interactive-storyteller.com.
Yeah, Jersey Drozd of comicsaregreat.com.
Looking forward to the day where we don't have to say .com anymore, when we're going to be able to get the top-level domains of just our names. So, like, our name is the address. That'd be nice. Dot Jersey. And then we'd say dot. I was talking with a guy this morning when I was having coffee with the E2R2 guys. And he was saying something about how he's new to Twitter. And he said that he can't get over this whole at person's name thing. And he said that he feels himself pausing when he's reading text and it says at the person's name. And I told him you get used to it and it almost becomes so second nature that when you see at next to anything, you just assume it's a username now. You know?
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, then we'll just be dot jersey dot Rob.
Dot muffin, dot egg.
So how you doing? What's going on?
I am doing pretty good. I am, working on a Justin from, starting my new full-time gig, which I'm enjoying, and not that I really need to share or journal that, but it's been fun. But it's totally that adjustment thing. Working on being in the groove with the Lean Into Art cast and everything else.
Yeah. So
some things are still waiting. Some plates are still laying on the table waiting to get spun up on a stick.
Oh, and in the warm-up show that we do that's available on leanintoart.com for people who have signed up for classes in the past. I was using the metaphor of don't tip the waiter, the old Parker Brothers game, or maybe it was, I don't remember who made that game now. It could have been a bunch of different companies. So you're talking about spinning plates. I'm talking about holding the plates in the big tray that are almost ready to fall at any given moment.
Yeah.
Yours sounds a lot more entertaining.
To abuse. Sorry.
No, go ahead. What did you say?
I said one of my favorite metaphors to abuse, that and stuntmen.
Well, but see, at least your metaphor sounds entertaining. Mine sounds stressful. I think your outlook is something I could learn from, Rob. Seriously. I'm not saying that just to be glad handling and being a buddy and everything, but I think I really could learn a lot from your viewpoint, your worldview. You have a natural disposition to look at things in a positive way, which is nice. Refreshing. The internet is an angry place, Rob.
Sure. You mentioned that this kind of thing before too, and it's it's a way that helps me keep in balance the giant ball of hate inside me.
Are we going to use that for a warm up show one of these times? Talk about the big black ball of hate inside of each of us.
Sure, like when a grasshopper spits. It's like, what is that like? Yeah.
That's what it looks like. Yeah. I just keep pushing it down, pushing it down, pushing it down. And then when I turn 50, I'll drop dead.
No, just got to get a midlife crisis mobile.
I need to make some money at this stuff in order to get the midlife crisis mobile, for crying out loud. Hey, everybody, take a workshop at leanintoart.com/workshops. Okay, topic. Part two.
I love our ham-fisted segues.
That's what I want to use from now on. All right, let's go. Like an old man. Okay. Peter Falk in The Princess Bride. That one. Okay. We're doing part two. We're doing part two to the episode that we started two episodes ago where you were talking about spreadsheeting.
I mean, it's kind of spreadsheeting. I mean, a spreadsheet is like this, on the surface, it's way not a creative tool. On one hand, it depends on how you look at computers. If you look at a computer as this incredible device that you are making science fiction happen to the world around you, and as time changes, more and more of these, you know, things that we've read about ages ago come true, it's a pretty damn mystical, awesome, powerful thing. And that to me gets me excited. And on the surface, and some things, and I guess, you know, maybe it's from the era I come from where a lot of computing was rough around the edges and ugly or brown or green and amber or whatever.
Yeah.
And it was still fun anyway to say, you know, 10, print, but 20, go to 10. And, you know,
I remember in 1985, I got a book from the Scholastic Book Club, which was How to Program Games on the Commodore 64.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And I remember sitting down and you know, I mean, they were those text games, right? So it was like, you know, it sort of made shapes on the screen with text sometimes. Sometimes something would move on the screen, but it was text-based stuff. You know, you had to press yes or no in order to move to the next stage of the game. But there was something really magical about writing these funny commands. And then all of a sudden I had a game where a monster, if I chose the wrong thing, would throw me down a bottomless pit, which was made of exclamation points that just scrolled, right? There's exclamation points on either side that changed position, and it just scrolled up the screen. Oh, you're in a bottomless pit. And it just keeps running and running and running forever. That kind of thing.
That rocks. I mean, yeah, especially when you're little, you're like typing this and not fully grasping the concepts of logic and whatnot. And,
yeah.
And, it's kind of like you're casting a spell.
It really felt like that. So yeah, it's creativity. I think that's something that we do tend to lose sight of, you know, as this stuff becomes more prosaic. I was watching a movie the other day from the 60s. I forget what movie it was. It might've been that Jack Lemmon film, How to Murder Your Wife, which is, boy, oh boy. It's like Mad Men as a comedy, where it's like just pure misogyny. The whole thing is just so misogynistic. And it's like, wow, this was acceptable to act that way in that time. Anyway, but in the film, somebody asks like a woman, like, what do you do for a living? She's like, oh, I work with digital computers. I'm like, what does that mean? Digital? Oh, that's right. Because there was a time where computers were not digital.
Ah, sure. That's right.
And so that would have been a new thing, you know? And so like we just take, and then today we take it for granted. So when you say digital computers, like what, whatever, it's like saying digital watch, all watches are, well, no, they're not. But anyway.
Oh yeah. I remember on game shows as a kid when a digital watch sometimes would be one of the big prizes. Like,
but so like, you know, spreadsheets, we take it for granted. It's like the symbol of the dreary office where all you're doing is data entry. You can't possibly use this thing to be creative.
Gosh, I'm trying to remember the inventor of VisiCalc, and you kind of caught me where I was trying to look it up. But
I can look it up while you talk about it.
He's, I was going to say it. I mean, basically before, you know, it's not like I'm an accountant or really even from that discipline. It's just, I think this, the behavior of this thing, it's like when someone finds an object and makes something else out of it. So you find this boring spreadsheet, this app that, you know, there's this grid and the columns and it's, you know, the alphabet and numbers, you know, there's no, you know, paper texture and brush lines and,
yeah, it doesn't have like the torn paper, like iCal. Right. It was Dan Bricklin.
Mm.
Refined by Bob Frankston, developed by their company Software Arts in 1979. I'm looking at it now. Black screen, green text.
Yeah.
Wow.
And if I remember, I think he had a rough go of it as his idea got stolen. That sucks. I don't mean to, you know, make light of his tough situation, but it, spreadsheets are a more interesting thing than they seem on the surface, as are, you know, computers, as is the whole darn world around you. Hopefully you've saw Reading Rainbow at some point. And, okay. So you've got this thing, the capabilities, and like, why would you care? Well, it has this structure to it, which, you know, for better or for worse, if you get over that hump and you think, well, what can I put in that grid? And we started to describe some of this before, and I don't mean to totally retread the territory, but we kind of described it and talked about using it to make some decisions and weight things out and whatnot. But the idea is, if you sort of list some things you're trying to decide between, and then you list some observations about those things. Let's say you're trying to decide about some brainstorm that you recently had, and you're working on generating your next story. And let's say you have a list of characters that came out of your brainstorming session. You have that in the left, the far left column of a spreadsheet, and across the top, you have attributes about those characters, kind of like a D&D spreadsheet, plus storytelling things that you care about. And let's say, yeah, okay, so you would maybe mention some visual things about the character, and you maybe would mention some of their role in the story, maybe their demeanor, their outward, what have you.
And one sentence description about the character, right?
Yeah, but then try to think of some things that are sort of like numeric things, like which ideas do you like, right? How are you feeling about this one? How are you feeling as far as like general liking of it? How are you feeling about how long it would take you to produce or design the character? How are you feeling about, you know, so break down these kinds of things and then go through the list and put numbers in them. Just like you were rating your next Netflix movies, yeah. Right? One to five stars. Or whatever number system you want. But one to five is pretty sufficient. And now you have this big grid of things, which you probably have run across at some point on a website to help you decide, like, well, you know, which laptop do I want? Which phone plan works better? Whatever. So you have this grid that you can now work through with and compare things, right?
Right, right. More easily compared with a visual representation of what the differences are and where the overlaps occur. This is very similar to what a lot of writing instructors have taught, and this is something I tripped upon intuitively. And then that little girl that is like the comic superstar of Ann Arbor, Natalia, who was on the Comics Great Show. I forget what episode it was, but it was a panel of preteens talking about making comics, and I still get really kind messages about that episode because the kids are all so smart. But even this, when she was 7 years old and when we first met her, she was doing charts of how the characters feel. She drew all the characters in two rows and then wrote out character relationships between each pairing, and then like, or not pairing, but let's say you got
the relationship.
The relationship between each and every one of those characters with just text written between them, right? So this is how this character feels about him. This is how he feels about her. This is how she feels about him. This is how she feels about the other guy. And I did the same thing with my projects. I didn't do it in a chart, but I would write out paragraphs of text saying, this is how these characters all feel about one another. This is Galen through Thirsty's eyes. This is Thirsty through Galen's eyes, you know, which at the time just seemed like good forethought to go into a project to really understand where the characters are coming from. But charting it, you know, as somebody who enjoys McLeod's books, I approve of this message, and I will subscribe to your newsletter, Rob.
Cool. I hope to get around to writing it someday. what is different with this, though, like a unique capability, something you can take advantage of here, is this extra aspect of sort of summarizing and visualizing this thing you've compiled. So you've invested this time, and you've either used numbers, and I like that you brought up, like, you can also use labels. And ideally, you have let's see, this can sound dorky or whatever, but like you have a strict vocabulary about these labels. So if you said that in these relationships, you could say so-and-so likes so-and-so, that's this other person, you know, this other person. And person A likes person B. Person C hates person B. And so if you look, you use that kind of, even if it's a phrase, but if you consistently use it, there, now you're getting into this data power of spreadsheets. So you've given it some consistent text, and you've given it some label text that's all that you want to sort of sort and think about. And you've added some numbers to it too, giving it these other angles of what you can do. You could, if you want, make a literal like chart, like a bar chart or a pie chart. Who's the most hated? Who's the most liked? Who
Oh, wow. Giving you a completely different way to visualize what you're writing as you write it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, now put this into the context of our prior conversation where it's like you're deciding among a car or different housing scenarios, right? And the same kind of thing applies. You using the spreadsheet gives you the power of a structured document. And with that structure, you have new ways to play.
And this actually doesn't sound that strange as somebody who's played Dungeons and Dragons before. Chaotic neutral, chaotic principled, or chaotic...
Lawful neutral, chaotic good, chaotic evil.
Yeah.
Chaotic neutral, yeah.
Yeah, and that those are just like, that's common terminology that helps you understand. It gives you good data that works cross user base. So somebody who played the system but never played in the same room as me will say, oh, I have a chaotic neutral elf, which everybody had a chaotic neutral elf. But who was a dark mage as well. Then I knew exactly what to expect from that character, right? So, yeah.
Exactly.
Taxonomy.
Yeah. Yep. Bingo. This is another way to look at it. It's a modeling exercise. So it's a modeling exercise as in a construction, a simplified construction of a more detailed concept that even though you're looking at it in simplified form or distilled to some key concepts, you can discover interesting relationships among the concepts and sift through it. The other thing is sifting. So if you have way too much data, then now you can really start filtering it in a more powerful way.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe there's too many cars you like, maybe there's way too many ideas you've generated.
Well, I mean, I think about that example you talked about where you could like process the data into a bar chart to see who's the most hated character in the story. And I think about that and I automatically started plugging in characters from my own books that I've written. And I thought, what would happen if I found out that nobody in the book likes this guy? You know, because when you're dealing with each and every character individually, you've got your magnifying glass on them, right? And you're not necessarily thinking lucidly about what the character relationships are. You're dealing with it sort of like on a case-by-case basis. And all of a sudden you rearrange that data and now it's like, wow, everybody hates this guy. Leads me to two questions. One, do I need to make a change here? Do I need to re-examine my cast and say, there's got to be somebody who sees a redeeming quality in this character? Or B, is that an interesting place to go? Examine why everybody hates this guy and why I'm choosing as an author to give them any time in the story. You know, that leads to more interesting questions as to investigate the story. Or it could lead you down a rabbit hole and you'll never return.
Exactly.
There's a danger in here, isn't there?
There's totally a danger. Well, and that's why other constraints are good to have. So if you have a time frame from in which you want to finish your first episode or what have you, you have a finite end or a situation you have to deal with. So you know that this modeling and analysis and idea generation and data sifting and all that could be fun. Like you're sold on it and it is creative and interesting. You have to have that way out of it too.
I mean, it's just another way to approach. What's reminding me of is, I'm going to talk about another Comics Are Great episode. This is the episode where I plug all of the other stuff I do. I don't remember what number it was. I'll have to look it up, but it was the episode I did with Luis Escobar, of LuisEscobarBlog.com. And, he talks about the Dramatica. You know,
remember that one.
So you've heard of this. Yeah. And it's a system that you can do without the program, but there's also a program. It's a desktop application that you plug your information into and it helps lead you through. It has leading questions to guide you through constructing a story. And it's by no means a clip arty kind of thing. But it's very much like a constructed data. What am I trying to say? Spreadsheet sort of, Words are failing me, Rob.
Structured. It's a structured way to look at writing a story, and it comes with a system.
Yes.
Wrapped around that structure to help guide you to put things in there and observe and revise to get through managing stories in a way that fit their system of managing stories.
Yes. Thank you. And they themselves say that it's to create a very specific kind of story, what they call the grand argument story. So it's something where they themselves disclaim that this isn't for everybody. But what you're talking about reminds me of that. It's just another way to approach, like, it looks like data entry, but writing on the page is data entry.
Exactly. And so not to overly try to sell it. It's just it has different strengths that may be useful and for a lot of different reasons. Even if like so, let's say you brainstorm your next story and you think of just a list of you brainstorm a raw list of words via some exercise, and then you just rank those words. And you find out, I want my story to have these. It's like a different way of creating sort of a mood board, right? Where you're gathering some things, prioritizing among them, and then putting them bringing them together and seeing how you feel about it.
Yeah.
As a whole.
We did this in one of the Lean Into Art 3030 labs, right? We did that exercise where I asked the participants to make word associations, like write down the name of your best friend in fifth grade, write down like a moment from this birthday party or whatever. I forget what the specific questions were, but they were all life moments, right? Moments that tend to have a vibrancy to them, like remembering like a close friend when you're a kid. And then we use those word associations to build. This is the one we did, right? Where we use those word associations to create a character.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, it was, the word associations to create a character. We did a few different character creation exercises, and there was the word association one for the individual character, and then there was the workshop you did that was more a different kind of association through pivotal emotional how would you describe though that list of things? It's like you're actually pivotal relationships.
Yeah.
And then using those as a way to inform an entire story, not just individual characters.
Right. And this comes back to an old idea, is that creating a set of initial parameters, it forces you to be more creative rather than just being, you know, I just want to be free. I just want to write what's inside of me. Okay, well, tell me a story, dude. And if you can, just jump into something like that, awesome, good for you. But a lot of us can't. I'm one of those guys who just can't go, story, let's see. You know, but if you tell me a story about bears in the woods in 1786 and something to do with rocks and fear. All right, then give me a starting point. I can go somewhere with that.
Yep.
You know, the bears are in the woods and they see a rock that looks like something that's like a monster of some sort. It has like an ominous presence. They get closer upon it and they realize that it's just some rocks. But then as they walk away, they find out that it's actually a rock monster. It starts chasing them. There you go. You got the beginnings of a story. That's not a good story. But anyway, my point is that, you know, people, I get this all the time. It's like, well, where do I begin? Well, you start with simple word association and just jotting down a list like this. And then writing what you associate with that will give you some clues. And especially if you're doing it from the hip and not overthinking it.
Exactly. Like this is a general thing. Like we probably will do some podcasts on this because I mentioned modeling, I mentioned analysis and the brainstorming. It's essentially doing creative activities that have this relationship with a structured approach, structured data, and then getting another round of creativity out of that from that result from the first round. Like one thing I came across this very recently. So I did an article on empathy in user experience. right? So what role does that play? Because I was just doodling on some note cards and I started thinking about like, well, what are some of the aspects that lead people to assume better or worse about their interaction, right? So when you're in person, why would you think better of someone who you were getting the same sort of service in a completely electronic interaction sense, right? Where you may jump to other conclusions and you know, maybe think less of them more rapidly, right? And I just started kind of with that as in mind, I started diagramming and coming up with a flow and steps in the diagram and filling it in over time and whatnot. Anyway, and it got me just thinking about, well, where in an interactive system what things could I focus on to try to crank up more understanding across both parties, right? Someone providing a service interactively and someone using it, right? Anyway, so I don't know. I ended up finding this other thing too that actually started my tangent, which is it's a diagramming related exercise. And I think what we could do in another episode like on diagramming and doodling and stuff specifically, but I think this is another, it's like a structured visual approach. And the thing I'm looking at is it's on the GameStorming blog, and it's called How to Create an Empathy Map. And
explain this.
Yeah. So again, it's you know, so you have this limiting structure that is helping you, you know, sort of capture ideas into its structured set of buckets. So you have on a piece of paper, a whiteboard, or in this article, they actually worked out how you could do this with Google Docs and have this exercise, which I would imagine you could do that then remotely. Which is kind of cool because there's a lot of those activities that are all about being in the room and facilitating, you know, in person, which I think is, it's obvious, it's the most powerful, but this is kind of neat. Anyway, so you have a simple diagram, you know, drawn or laid out that has sort of an X, a large rectangle with an X in the middle, but on top of it, not under the X, is a person. So you're not crossing them out.
Okay.
And what you've done then is you've created these quadrants of surrounding the person. So above them is from an empathy perspective, is how do they think and feel? And then to the left is what are they hearing? To the right, what are they seeing? Below them, what do they say and do? And then add one more row below that two rectangles, one called pain, one called gain. And now you're trying to put yourself in this modeling exercise by brainstorming and coming up with ideas. You're trying to identify with another person in this structured manner. And that's probably helpful for, you know, people who have a day job doing user experience or maybe even any kind of design, honestly, come to think of it.
Yeah.
It's very much a designy informing exercise. But then another angle I would consider is I would have two colors of post-it notes. I would essentially have each of those as the perspective. Is like, what is the perspective of that person? So that's like the core empathy thing. That's one color post-it note. Then the other color would be, what are you trying to do for them? And in those different dimensions. What do you want them to see? How do you want to help them with that kind of thing? And then see, then you can actually have a different observation of how is it all matched?
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That this is something that totally I was doing intuitively before, but now I want to try this out when I'm writing characters. So you're going to send me a link to that, right? How to Create an Empathy Map, GameStorming blog.
Yep.
That sounds really interesting to map out each and every one of your characters. This reminds me of something that I know I've talked about in other places. This idea of writing your characters with perfect love. And I'm borrowing from Campbell again. He talks about you know, oh gosh, this was at the end of the last episode we did, I think episode 35, we talked about, you know, what's lovable about a person is their faults. And the author's job is to name those faults with perfect love. You're not doing it to assault them. You're not doing it to ridicule them. You're doing it to say, look at this wonderfully flawed human being, right? And it seems like doing an empathy map would be a great way to discover those flaws with the right attitude. Does that make sense?
Yeah, exactly.
You're not just saying like, oh, he's obsessive compulsive. Well, why did you make him obsessive compulsive? Well, it's a flaw. And therefore, you know, it'll make it more interesting.
Yeah. Because if you find yourself saying, because those people are funny or what have you, that means you're probably not putting yourself in their shoes.
Because that's true.
It's just a little rule of thumb.
Well, you could, but then you got an Adult Swim show. Sorry. That was cheap. Okay. So, I didn't want to lead us too far astray with that. Sorry about that. Where else we got on this?
Well,
so you got seeing potential relationships, you know, visualizing change over time and, you know, we didn't talk about this yet. Visualizing change over time.
Yeah.
This was in your notes here. What do you mean by that?
Well, this is one of the benefits of if you do this repeatedly, because then you'll have sort of a, I think it's totally valid to just have a reflective moment and think like things got better from point A to point B, right? In this last year in my, you know, in my comic or in my whatever project I'm doing. But wouldn't it be kind of interesting to be able to now apply this kind of observation at a few different snapshots over this a similar exercise? So what if you did this again for something that where that would matter? Probably for me that has to do with planning goals and weighing out like what projects I want to focus on for the next year and that kind of stuff.
We did an episode on self-assessment, didn't we?
Yeah.
It seems like I remember doing that, so.
Yeah, it's way related to that.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where I like to, cause the other aspect of the change over time is the multivariable aspect, or problems that just are kind of complicated. So maybe you do, a few different brainstorming exercises with a couple different spreadsheets and through that process gain a new perspective because it can be really complex. So, scenarios. Right. Where scenarios that aren't just driven by do I like or dislike and rank a list of things? Well, things that are more complicated than one simple observation. Things like I've used spreadsheets to help me when I'm doing an interviewing process for my place of work, where I think about how do I it's like a self-survey and having multiple questions on it. Each question is its own variable.
Yeah.
And those are situations that I think are, if you're open to doing that kind of, or if you're of the inclination to want to play with it in a structured way, spreadsheets are pretty awesome for that because they handle those problems pretty well.
Well, let's talk about this real quick. I want to get to the nitty gritty of like what you actually mean when you say asking yourself these questions, because for a moment, I use spreadsheets myself and I like them, but I don't have nearly close to the Kung Fu Panda mojo that you've got with your ability to do spreadsheets. I only recently found out about sums and was like, this is cool. I can make math happen on the page. you can have different spreadsheets interact with each other? What?
Sure.
But when you say ask yourself questions, are you saying that, okay, field one, column one, how do I feel about this character? Tab over to column two, I like him. Or are you doing something differently with the way the spreadsheet is structured when you're asking yourself these questions? Because let's go back. You talked about taxonomy and choosing the right words is or using a consistent taxonomy is the only way to get any kind of sortable data, right?
Yeah.
And if you just write like, I like him. Oh, he feels funny. She has nice hair. Well, that's not data that you can actually do anything.
Well, depends on how you do that. Where if you, so now you think, now you've named multiple attributes. Just to, in your example, so you've said their type of hair. Mm-hmm. You've mentioned probably what they're. What do you like about them? Think about what you meant by that. Did you mean their demeanor? Did you mean they smell good? Did
so then you would say demeanor would be a column.
Yep.
In the spreadsheet.
And their odor and their hair.
Yeah. Demeanor, odor, and hair—that those are the three qualities that I'm always thinking about when I'm writing my characters.
Yeah, exactly. So, or you could get really interesting, like to say, how good of a pet monkey handler would they be, right? Mm. Level of skill, right. And yeah. Anyway, you can get very general or specific, and just breaking it down into attributes of that thing. That you're thinking about, and in the structure part of it is to not cram it all into one column and just
right.
If you need
speed, stamina, endurance,
exactly
intelligence, right?
Though that's a multivariable problem. That's another right. The each one of those attributes is a variable, and I honestly think people are pretty darn smart. Where you don't need to do that structured approach always. You can follow your gut, and you may. Find your spreadsheet just echoes your same thing. And you think, well, you know, good job, me. Thanks, me. Maybe it was a waste of time. But I actually often find that I find some extra nuance there because it's really hard sometimes to depends on what the variables are. And maybe you want to get some perspective on them. So another example would be, well, kind of related to Tyler James's class, where he has a very, very disciplined approach to going to conventions and tabling. And so I could easily see taking his class and having a list of, like a self-survey, observations of how did you do in these different categories, the categories that matter to you, right? Mm-hmm. So that's, you can find other people's questions and surveys and you reuse those. But the other awesome thing is the spreadsheet's blank. Put whatever darn attributes you matter to you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, when I do library events, they always hand out survey sheets at the end. Mm. You know, rate your experience. We need feedback from you in order to know if we should do more stuff like this. And some libraries have very interesting questions posted on there. Really good questions that try to get some solid data out of the mm-hmm. attendee. And then I go to other ones where it's like, rate your experience 1 to 5 and oops. Nothing else is on there.
Experience? I'm really experienced. 5.
Yeah. Or you know, it's like, I'm glad I brought my Game Boy. I had an awesome game of Zelda. 5. Great experience today. You know, presenter was boring as heck, but.
I'm sorry.
What?
Well, you're pointing out something that it's easy to BS and hack this approach, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're measuring something, it's worth, you know, trying to curate it in a way that you'll get something useful out of it. Because sometimes a survey isn't asking the right kinds of questions.
Well, I mean, it comes down to... whenever you go to a convention and you walk around and you talk to all the other cartoonists, you're like, how's the show going for you? Good, good. Right?
Exactly. Like I'm going to say, I'm really frustrated. My chair is uncomfortable. Yep. And, you know, and I had someone damage my books and whatever.
In that context, that's not the time or place to really bring that up. But that's like when somebody asks you, how are you? You know, it's a norm in the United States to just go good, no matter how good or bad it is. And like, there's always stories about somebody coming to the United States from a foreign country, and like you say, how are you? And like, oh, terrible, and they start actually telling you because they interpret the question as not being rhetoric or rhetoric rather. But you think about that as being like, this is a way to model this kind of a thinking, is like when you ask somebody at a convention, how you doing? Good, good. They're always going to say that. Then the question is, well, good how? And so, yeah, I think asking yourself to fill this spreadsheet with the information that's important to you. So I would put in, sure, like strength, speed, stamina, intelligence, endurance, skill, all that stuff. But then I would also, like, when I think about my characters, and we're using characters as an example here,
mm-hmm.
I think about what's their function in the story. I would create, like, a grid of quadrants of what are four functions that I want to use to achieve my idea or my thesis or my big thought of the story. Mm. Is this a character who is actively pursuing the thesis? Is this a person who is actively resisting the thesis? Is this a person who negatively reinforces the thesis? You know, like, these are different kinds of character types I've explored. You know, it's like where this character represents the core thesis, but in a negative inflection. This character represents the core thesis in a positive inflection, right? They're both agreeing on the idea, but they both have a very, very different viewpoints on it. And that would be the kind of information I would capture in such a thing, right?
Yeah, that sounds like a really cool idea. I'm writing that down.
And I use that as a filtering mechanism. Now, I didn't do this on a spreadsheet before, but I would do this in writing, where mm-hmm. I would use this as a filtering mechanism to figure out, so case in point, the original comic that became the front graphic novel, I did as a seven issues back in the 90s as mini comics and self-published comics. And in it were two characters who didn't make it into the graphic novel reboot. Their names were Quincy and Stiletto. And I remember the two people in the world who read the original comics when they saw the new webcomic were like, where's Quincy and Stiletto? Why didn't you put them in? Because I sat down, and when I was writing the story, I wrote down what their character functions were. I wrote down how long their scenes would take to really get them introduced into the story. And I evaluated that against what I'm trying to accomplish in X amount of pages. And I realized that it wasn't a situation where I said, well, they just got to go because there's no room just because I feel it in my gut. I mean, I wrote out enough information to where I knew that these guys are going to warrant a whole chapter in and of themselves to introduce them into the story. And I don't have room for the scope of this project. I'll save it for another story. Maybe I'll introduce them down the road. Maybe I won't. I don't know. But for right now, I've done enough writing to know that these guys don't fit. Does that make sense?
That totally makes sense.
And their function in the thesis that I was trying to get at, their function would have been redundant. It was already being taken care of through characters like Galen and Max. I didn't need them to reinforce the idea. It just would have been more of what I was already doing with Galen and Max.
Whereas if you were writing a novelization, you may actually add five more, depending. I mean, not that all novels do that, but to me, it's a different kind of experience, different constraints, you know, different design concerns.
Yeah.
That is really cool. I have an urge to create my storytelling spreadsheet, you know, and take another swing.
I think that's a good way of looking at it, is like, yeah, you don't look at it. What I'm really glad that we're not doing here is that we were coming up with, here's a test spreadsheet and just use this, kids. And, you know,
right.
If you got to modify it, you got to modify it. But, you know, it's like the big idea is come up with your own. Think about what questions are important to you and plug them into the spreadsheet. This whole idea of thinking about character function in a story is something I like to do, but I've talked with other people who call that cookie cutter storytelling. You know, it's like, well, you're just coming up with a bunch of pre-designed templates of things and sort of matching your information to that. I don't agree with that. That's what I'm doing, but I totally see how they would see it that way. You know,
yeah.
Some people see, I'm a big fan of stories that play on classic, timeless ideas. I say classic and timeless. Other people say tread it out or hackneyed, or, you know, it's just viewpoints. That's just viewpoints. We're both looking at the garden, but we each got our own sitting place, right? I see a tree, I see a rock, right? And I got all Zen on everybody. But you know what I'm saying? This is just a by the numbers adventure tale, to which I say, oh, it's a timeless adventure tale. There's a reason that idea gets reused, because it communicates beyond generations. And even if we have seen it before, there's new details on it. There's a fresh perspective on it. So it's new, but it's timeless. whereas other people don't see it that way. So, I mean, all I'm saying is that we each have our own vector, our own approach into this thing, and we should, God, you know, I'm going to use this quote again. Neil Adams once said that your style is what you do wrong.
Mm.
And that's not to say that that's letting you off the hook of getting better at what you do, but
oh no,
there is a time. And there's a time to embrace your own idiosyncratic approach to something. There's a time to be instructed, and there's a time to instruct yourself. How about that?
That feeds into if you revisit this over time, you may find out how you looked at it in the earlier version. Maybe it doesn't map at all. Maybe you can't really see the change over time other than like, wow, do I think of this differently? And then just move on. I've done that before. There's definitely spreadsheets that I don't think I would need to repeat, but it was a good exercise. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's, I find it helpful to make sense out of a complex situation. Like I'll refer to the one that was, I really have a mixed bag feeling about this, this one spreadsheet idea nothing bad was in it, but it was essentially thinking of, the feedback form that you described, Jersey, for your, library workshops or whatnot, but it was for people who were going through an interview, and it's very fine tuned for a specific kind of programming role, mm-hmm. like, you know, programmer in a corporate IT environment kind of thing. And I mentioned in the prior episode that I noticed that a lot of us who were all involved in this process, it was nice that we had different approaches, but it was really hard to have useful conversations in the end. So I thought, well, what if we had observations based on this, and we shared the same observations, and we could just talk about that as a summarized result. So it would be things like, how is this person how did you feel about their skill with this technology, that technology? How did you feel about their presentation ability? So would they be, analysis, and then hitting different aspects of technology, whatever kind of our attributes that made sense for that environment. Mm-hmm. And, they became our attributes. And, on one hand, I think it helped move the conversation along, but on the other hand, you can get trapped by this stuff.
Yep.
And you can start looking at this external expression as like, it's doing the thinking for you.
Or, if the words aren't chosen just right, you could get somebody who gets tripped up on ambiguity, right? Sure. So, like, for instance, you say, like, was the presenter engaging?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
God, what does that mean? Did he shout a lot to get my attention? Yeah, you bet. Or was he enchanting? You know, did he or she bewitch me with their enthusiasm or presentation or whatever? You know, it's like, what do you mean by this specific word? So you can also, I'm very close to somebody who I will not name who gets really hung up on ambiguous words. And mm-hmm. in a multiple choice scenario, he or she will completely lock up over, well, is it, it's kind of both. It's kind of both A and B, you know, and it's like, what is the question actually asking for here? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so there was a bit of a learning curve to get everyone using that tool, but it didn't take much. And that's where I knew I thought it was on a trail to having a shared conversation helper thing. And in the end, so we had a bunch of attributes, and we had scores on all the attributes, and we had a summary, right?
Yeah.
And so that's one of the cool things you can do on a spreadsheet. You don't have to start making bar charts and fancy other things. You just, like Jersey said, you can. I didn't want to dive deep into the programmy, Cody feeling aspect of it, but like it's really a big powerful thing on spreadsheets where you can, it's called a function, right? Or a formula.
Formula.
Either way. And you can in one of the cells, instead of putting a number or an attribute or a label or whatever, you put this little function, and it you can say sum and then parentheses and then select the list of cells that you want to add up. And all of a sudden, bam, you have a summary, right? And so that can be pretty handy when you're looking at about 25, 30 different attributes, and then you have one final one that you can get to look at if you're just quickly scanning. So that that can help a lot. And especially when you're looking at a sea of numbers and you're like, I think this person scored well.
Yeah.
Well, okay, now you know because you're comparing the summary as opposed to you're glancing across all the numbers.
Yep.
And that can be very useful.
Here's another dumb example, but let's say you got two characters. It's the age old like Clerks conversation of who would win in a fight, the Hulk or the Thing, right? And who knows, who cares? But that's a question that leads fans down rabbit holes, and they argue endlessly about it. That may be something you want to keep ambiguous. It might be something where you want that data because that might be of use to you, at some point in the story, right?
Yeah, it's a way for I think it's a way for your rational creative approach and your it's the old art and story art mullet thing.
Oh where, yeah,
yeah. You can have these two aspects of your creativity communicating to one another through this translation.
Yes.
Another thing is here's a tangible example for the spreadsheet that I like to do is, so if I'm puzzling or overwhelmed or just not getting something about a situation, like sometimes time management, right? I will actually start listing stuff out and adding it up and then comparing it. So I'll quickly capture things like how many hours in a day, how many hours in a work week, how much on the weekend, how much. And I start thinking about my activities and giving them hours and looking at, well, where am I spending my time? And then having this spreadsheet view of it. And you can go pretty darn granular with that if you care to. One of the examples that I've used this for is a bit of material for ideally, I think it was a constructive conversation, but it was a critique on, a policy from a place that I was working at that essentially had it laid out where essentially, I don't think it was malicious or necessarily, heavily thought out ahead of time, but there were numbers thrown out as far as how many hours a person was to be billable and how many they had for other things and whatnot. And so I did this up in a spreadsheet to say, let's see what this means.
Yeah.
And,
is this the billable time fallacy that you promised to get to?
Yeah. I'm talking about the billable time fallacy. And, as with any critique or feedback, you got to be, in my opinion, it's important to be careful of know your audience and all that. I wouldn't want any, side topic. I want us to come up with an endearing, caring, honoring, fun nickname for the people that choose to listen to this show. Because leaners kind of doesn't float my boat.
Leaners?
Yeah.
Leaners aren't wieners.
And I had fun with that, but then I'm like, I'll listen to the podcast and be like, leaners aren't wieners. And I'm like, hey, wait a minute.
It does sound like the proletariat, right? It's like, keep leaning, leaners.
Sure. Oh, gosh. Yeah. It's like.
Or it reminds me of time to lean, time to clean, right?
Totally.
You shiftless lagabouts, quit leaning. Right. So, yeah. Okay. Well, let's put it to let's call out to the listeners. What do we think we should call the listeners?
What honors that thing that why do we care to talk about this topic? I mean, yeah, Jersey and I will take some swings at this once in a while, but like, what do you guys think?
Yeah. I'm in the same boat with Comics Are Great. We just chose to name our project something where it's like you can't just say like the Lean Into Art Army. See, that's also antithetical to my viewpoint. It's like, oh, I don't want to be the guy who claims to be at the head of an army.
Right.
We're the first among equals, right? We just happen to be the ones doing the talking at the moment. Oh, we're holding the conch.
To lean into art peers.
Yeah. See, I don't know.
That's a little too. There's no oomph in it. You know?
Yeah. There's no edge to it. That's like dad.
Doesn't have that feeling. It doesn't have to be edgy like a spiky hedgehog, right? I mean, it's got to be. Or, you know, a skateboarding rat or what have you. But
skateboarding rat. Oh, you just took me back to 1991.
Totally.
Oh, man, that's great. Yeah, I know what you mean, though. It's like if the edgiest I get is Weird Al Yankovic edgy, right? Where it's like self-deprecating sort of edginess.
Sure. Or food, stinky food, stuff like
stinky
that.
Food. Yes, yes. And not to say that I'm as funny as Weird Al. It's just that's the humor I relate to. That's the edginess I relate to, you know. So, yeah. Well, listeners, if you want to
listen. Maybe we should. Dude, what if we do a Google Doc? What if we share a Google Doc for this? I don't know.
Oh, let the listeners.
Like, we could do a Google Doc spreadsheet, you know?
And then we can have the users rate them. Have the listeners rate the different entries.
Yeah, we could play around with that. See what, and maybe we'd have to do a little bit of the curated version where it's like you submit it, you can see the results, and then we'll, you know. Yeah. So they don't go live. So everyone's like, you know, on the lean into art poopers, you know. Give it 10 stars.
Lean into art poopers. Yeah, that would the lean into art poopsies. Yeah, there we go. Oh no, I don't want to say poopsies every episode. That's terrible.
Nope.
Or yeah, like a swear or something. Okay. Well, hey, you know what? We'll check mark that and say like this is flagged for follow up, and we'll make some noise on the Twitters and on the lean into art Google Plus page, whichever one we decide to use more.
Yeah.
So, Lean's art naming.
Let's see. Did we finish up? Yeah. I think we covered it. That time management one can be really interesting. We should start thinking about.
Oh, man. You're talking to a guy who spent, you know, a full video episode extolling the virtues of David Say's Emergent Task Planner. Still using it, still loving it, you know? Grabbing that data to be able to look at, and now see, this is different because I'm writing it on paper. So if I was actually entering it into, there's apps that do that, aren't there? There's like time management apps that watch what you're doing.
I've been experimenting with them a little bit, and I haven't found one that I love. I run OS X as my OS X Lion is my main OS, and I've been playing around with a couple, and let's see, Time Sync, and something else. Anyway, they're okay. It's tough to, because it's like, if your pencil's moving, Jersey, do you know what you're doing for sure?
Right.
And if each app is a different kind of pencil or a pen or whatever, it's like, okay, that app for half hour, this app for 2 hours. Okay. Not that informative.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. In the data that I'm capturing with the ETP, the Emergent Task Planner, tends to be very vague. Right, it's like from this block to this block. Like, I mean, I'm usually using it for specific tasks, so like inking. I'll put inking page 9 right on the task planner, and then I'll chart how many blocks of time that takes. And then, all right, once that's done, I draw a line and it says done, and then I put scanning, you know, and then mark how much time scanning takes, and so on. Which sounds like a lot of work, but it's really not, because I'm just writing a word on a timesheet. Mm-hmm. In the time that I'm doing that specific thing, coloring page 9, you know, and then I'll put in there break if I take a break, you know, because like my body is a biological thing, unfortunately, and it suddenly says like, hey, put food in me, and I go, God, I just fed you 12 hours ago. Yeah, but I need more. I'm trying to get some work done here, and I really do swear at myself like that when like I'll get lightheaded and I'm like, oh, it's time to eat, man.
Anyway. Yeah, that's the price for doing something that you're immersed in. I'm glad you reminded me of the Emergent Task Planner. I keep a log, where, you know, just from consulting and you know, and now what I'm doing for a day job too. I keep a log.
And then at the end of each ETP day, I write down, I log how much time each thing took. so that I both have a visual timeline view, but then I also have a summary view of, okay, page 9 took X amount of time all told, right? So from penciling, inking, to scanning, to flatting, took 3.5 hours. And so I have at the bottom of each page, a quick, easily scannable log of how much time I'm actually using on this stuff. And I get to watch how that changes. And then when I see a change, like, wow, why did it take 5 hours today? Oh, I know why it took 5 hours, because I got 3 phone calls that day that were business-related phone calls that took me out of that place, and then I had to go back into that place. You know, so I can see how different things affect my workday. I hate getting phone calls, Rob. I don't know about you, but I hate it when my phone rings so much.
I mean, it depends. If it's too early, that's frustrating. Too late, that's frustrating. And, or if it's just, it's like a little, my own little gambling machine where I look at it and I'm like, I don't know this number. And some days I'm like, yeah, let's gamble, you know?
Let's see what happens when I do this. No, there's a window of time in my day when this is where I'm going to sound really uptight and like I'm going to be all prescriptive about this is the right way to live. No. There's a window of time in my day where it's okay if the phone rings, and it's like only like a 2 hour block. And by the way, that's usually when you call me. Thank goodness. That's why I sound so cheerful when I answer the phone. but any other time of the day is like, oh, I mean, Anne was upstairs working on something. I was in the studio downstairs working on something, and she decided that in order to get my attention, she'd call me on the phone. I didn't know she was calling me. I didn't know it was her, right? All I knew was my phone was ringing. And I did this audible, oh, you know, because I was being interrupted by the darn phone. And she thought I knew it was her.
Oops.
So I was like, oh, it's her. So I answered it, you know? And then she's like, well, what was that? What was that all about? I'm like, oh, it's just the phone ringing. She's like, oh, that's how you respond whenever I call you? No, of course not.
But being married is fun. That's good comedy, honestly.
I hate it when my phone rings when I'm working on something. If it's in the non working on something time, it's like I'm happy to answer the phone. Oh, great, phone. Get to talk to somebody that I like. But any other time of the day, it's like, oh God.
Yeah, it's a little random need box. It's like, I need you, I need you, need you, need you, ring,
and,
ring, ring.
And this has been discussed elsewhere, but like one of the problems of cellular phones is that it's expected that we are reachable at any given time, right? Why didn't you answer? What do you mean an answer? I know your phone was on your person. I was driving, you know? That's not an answer, you know?
I had what I referred to with an inappropriate name back in the day, but it was a pager.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, exactly. I was a high-rolling janitor and troubleshooter. But I was on call and all that kind of stuff pretty much, you know, a lot. So I figured out like habits with that thing and how to, you know, have some boundaries with the stupid thing. It's like, okay, find your little need box. Whatever. I'm going to put you under a pillow which I'm shoving under the couch.
Yep.
And, you know,
I'm going to put it in a box, put that box inside another box, and I'm going to bury that box in the backyard.
Yep.
We are totally astray of where we were, but I wonder if that means we're done.
I think we are.
Okay.
I think if we look around, it's like, okay, we've made the loop, you know? Our walk is complete.
That's right. That's right. That's the metaphor we always use, is an hour-long perambulation. does that sound nice and pretentious?
It's cool. I like that. I like hour-long perambulation gum, actually.
It's good for your teeth, actually. Mm-hmm. All right. So, hey, everybody, if you liked what we talked about today, then a great way to thank us would be to go to iTunes and give us a star review. And the reason that I ask you to do it is not to give us a boost of our ego. You know, I'm doing just fine. I'm looking in the mirror and saying, hey, not too shabby, as I'm sure Rob is okay with himself, too. But what it does do is it helps make us more visible to other people who may find this information useful. There is somebody out there. So let's say, okay, I'm going to be you for a second, listener, who we don't have a name for yet. I remember when I found whenever I find a podcast that I really, really enjoy, I'm like, oh my gosh, this podcasting thing is amazing, because it's like there's a whole world of radio out there that is made, tailor-made for me. You know, I remember the time when there was talk radio, but there wasn't podcasting, and I turn on talk radio and it's like, I saw a UFO once and it was in my backyard, or this is why, you know, this is why people who wear blue shirts are ruining the country. You know, it's like all sorts of craziness, but it never pertained to me. It was entertaining, but it didn't actually have anything to do with my life or what my interests are. But then I found these shows where it was like, wow, this was like, it was tailor-made for me. I can't be the only person who enjoys this. So you give a star review on iTunes, it helps that other person out there who's looking for this kind of stuff find thing that is useful to them. So you're doing a service, not to us, but to everybody else who may enjoy this. That was my way of framing it.
I think it's fair. It's basically you're inviting more people to the party
in an anonymous, risk-free way, because all you got to do is just hit however many stars you think we deserve. You could put one. I'd rather you didn't, but if that's what you think we deserve, then so be it.
Then such is life. Our Sisyphean, be doing the podcast will be our Sisyphean task instead of
we'll just constantly keep cranking out material that people go fail to. It's what I expected it to be. All right. Well, hey, guess what? Let's get out of here. Thanks, everybody, for downloading and listening. And let us know what you think we should call the Lean Into Art listenership. Something that honors you and is affectionate, yet also humorous, right? Is that what you said?
Yeah, a little lighthearted, but, you know, like the just capturing the right spirit, right? The honoring thing, I think, is a good guiding.
Yeah, I think so too. I think so. Like a loving parody, you know, like a parody that loves its subject, right? Like how some people describe the latest Muppet movie or the Brady Bunch movie, right? Mm. That kind of thing. All right, that's the ethos that I always look for. So, okay, everybody, thank you once again. We will be back again next week. Until then, I have been Jersey Drozd of comicsaregreat.com and Jersey on Twitter.
And I've been Rob Stenzinger of interactive-storyteller.com and Rob Stenzinger on Twitter.
Okay, bye.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user leanintoart, and you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leaners aren't wieners. Thanks for listening.